Tonight, I'm going to start my reflections with a story. And this is a story that the Buddha told a group of fully awakened monks, actually. They're all sitting in Jetta's Grove. And the monks had come to him with a question, and I'll talk more about their question in a moment. But first, I'm going to tell a version of the story that he told. Basically, he said, "Once upon a time, there was a king and four princes. And the four princes had heard their father talk about this really unusual tree, a kingsuka tree, or which roughly translates to a whatchamacallit tree. And so the princes were curious and they wanted to go visit it, but their schedules, princes have very busy schedules like us, and they could only go one at a time. So the charioteer would take them one at a time and go to see this tree. And the first one he took in a season where in the center of this forest there was this tree. It was like this big black thing with little tiny green buds on it. And the prince was duly impressed. They went back to the kingdom, the castle. He took the next prince a few months later. And the tree was in full bloom, flowers. And then yet another season, the other prince went, and the tree was dormant. And then finally, the last prince went when the tree was in full leaf, but not flowering. And at some point, all four princes and the dad were back around the dinner table talking, and the subject of this whatchamacallit tree came up. And each prince was advocating that the tree looked and was exactly how it was when he saw it. And they couldn't agree because it looked so dramatically different. So they weren't quite arguing, but they were a little, it was getting a little testy in there. And then the father was like, "Wait a minute, wait a minute, you're not understanding. This particular tree changes dramatically with the seasons. Looks one way in one season, another way in another season, like a banyan tree or a stump, or like it's on fire, or like a big giant green bush. It's all the same tree. It's just that the conditions around it are different." So I like this story because just about like with the Kintsugi tree, the Buddha is making a point, which is different methods of practice can be used to wake up. And the experience of the moment of awakening or a moment of awareness that leads to awakening might look different depending on the causes, the conditions, the practices used to cultivate it. And he goes on to say to these four monks, after telling this story, the Buddha did, they were all four fully awakened, right? They knew that the taste of nibbana, the taste of full awakening, was the same, but they were confused about the different ways that they'd experienced that moment right before their full awakening. And so he was a little bit chiding them not to get hung up on experience over insight, on the details more than the awareness. So tonight I'm going to talk about one area of these methods that these different monks used, and that is recognizing the many different forms of mindful awareness that can emerge in formal practice or in daily life. This is known, as many of you know, as the third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of citta, of heart mind. Like the Kintsugi tree, awareness looks really different depending on the conditions of our lives, of our minds, of the moment. It could be moment to moment awareness that's popping, kind of like popcorn or grains of sand. Or more broadly, kind of wave-like experiences of sensation. Or more broadly, different seasons of our heart and our minds. How much concentration is there? How much mindfulness is there that day? How much compassion, maybe? The point is that all of these forms of awareness are valid, and all of them can be onward leading to awakening. Right? So part of the process of broadening, maturing mindful awareness is recognizing all the different forms it can take. And the condition for being able to recognize the different forms awareness can take includes hearing them described, describing them as different experiences, phases, changes. And in reality, everything I described tonight, all of these things can shade into each other, and there are things I'm not going to talk about that can totally be valid experiences. The point is that they're all good, they're all worthy of attention, and there's no need to rank them. I'm going to kind of present them in an order, and perhaps even in some ways it could be considered developmental order, but that doesn't mean one is a hierarchy over the other. Okay? So, broadly, to go back to this simile of a tree, this story of a tree, we can imagine mindful awareness as being represented by the fact of noticing a tree, by a tree with buds, a tree in leaf, a flowering tree, and a fruiting tree. And we can also envision the whole forest around the tree, the ecosystem, the biosphere upon which it depends. The fact of seeing the tree is wholehearted presence. It's showing up in the moment. Right? I think of the buds, the potentiality of this moment-to-moment awareness. Leafing out, the ability to take in nourishment, is a kind of meta-level awareness, a second order of attention, of content and process. The Pali for that is patisati. It's awareness of awareness, self-reflexive awareness. And then there's the flowering of more of a full awareness, context and conditions. And the fruit is wisdom, care, discernment. So first, the moment-to-moment mindfulness awareness. This is just being with wholeheartedly whatever arises in formal meditation and in life. It's being completely present. Flow states include this, right? That moment of lucidity when doing something really important, really engaging. It's a huge difference being completely attentive versus being kind of checked out, right? It makes a big difference. I was just talking to a friend who's very kind of senior practitioner in the Zen tradition. And she's sort of running a 3-month event right now. And she's talking about how much she loves it, because even though it could feel like a lot of work, her attention is completely undivided. And so it nourishes her, feeds her. The wholehearted presence actually gives her steam, right? We've all had moments like this. Feeds on itself. So another level of this mindful awareness is the moment-to-moment awareness, moment-to-moment mindfulness. That too can be a flow state. In Pali, this is kanika samadhi, moment-to-moment samadhi, flow. But this is more, rather than that general wash of everything, it is one breath at a time, one little tiny sensation at a time. One sound coming and going at a time. intentionally allowing all of these micro moments to string together. We begin to notice the process of, say, breathing and all the micro sensations within an in-breath, at the top of an in-breath, and in an out-breath, that moment of stillness at the end of the out-breath. All of it scintillating, changing, morphing, moving, like raindrops striking water. Sometimes little bursts of moments like this, of awareness, will just happen on their own, right? People talk about time slowing down at certain moments. And it can take this place of the overall gestalt or this beautiful kind of tapestry of detail coming and going. In either way, it's meeting reality as it is in that moment. During hiking, walk with a friend, tasting food or drink, moments of clarity can arise right inside of these experiences. It can be like the striking of a gong in the mind, this momentary brightening. Or maybe like a single shooting star through the night sky. Either way, continuity can build. A single star can become the wash of the Milky Way. All those little points. Sometimes there's a single big flash of insight, right? So then, we've talked about wholehearted presence and this moment-to-moment mindfulness. When the leafing starts to happen, the ability to really take nourishment, onward leading nourishment from the practice, often involves a second level attention. That reflexive attention I was talking about, the patisati. And this can involve, can look different ways. Like the first way a lot of people notice it as kind of a step back. The ability to lens out, zoom out a little bit of experience. Experience can be subtle and precise or have some distance from it. Then it's not necessarily subtle and precise. But that in itself, the knowledge, the understanding that there's a little bit of distance between experience and the knowing of it, wow, that's huge, right? Stephen Covey quotes Viktor Frankl in talking about how between stimulus and response is a space. In that space lies freedom. There's the opportunity to make a shift. There's a massive difference there. If I'm stressed, knowing I'm stressed, rather than allowing myself to build castles of thought out of the stress and believe stories that hook me in and actually make it worse, it's a huge difference. With this second level attention for myself, I noticed as it began to develop that humor and lightness, even a kind of playfulness, naturally started to emerge in noticing this. And they can be a real ally in your practice. Joseph Goldstein talks about playing Atari with his thoughts on retreat. I think most of us here are old enough to remember Atari, right? You would just like shoot down the thoughts, not in a violent way, but just noticing past, present, future. And present is what is to be attended to. The past and the future are just the little blips on the screen, right? That discernment, but with a playful attitude. For myself, I remember one retreat, and kind of a period of some months in my life, I was just in the grip of a grudge, just not any fun at all. Resentment, one of the classic hindrances. And one of The turning points came for me when the mind recognized, oh, this is a grudge. And something playful inside started seeing it as like a cartoon troll rather than the content. And then the troll could like march away in a huff, but the mind could stay present. And it was that playfulness of, oh, it's just that. It's like the troll-like part of my own mind that gave the distance to allow it to eventually dissolve. I'm saying this in part because holding it lightly is super helpful. And sometimes as meditators, we get the idea that it's not okay to use imagination. But as humans, it's kind of hard to avoid imagination. We may as well make it our ally instead of being hooked by it, right? So to get creative, it's okay. So then awareness begins to flower. And here I'm talking about what Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about as full awareness, sampajanna, sati sampajanna. Contextual awareness is Bhante Sujato's translation. I really like that one. And this is the beginning of a different kind of wisdom, a little bit of a wisdom of the bigger picture. Like walking with a friend. Oh, knowing I'm walking. And knowing that friend is here, and maybe being conscious of multiple levels of what's happening, not just the content of the conversation, but the birds around, the trees around, the other people may be present, the emotions of my friend, my own responses. Just knowing the context. Or knowing, what kind of response is helpful in this moment? There's the internal reactivity or habituated response. And then what is the moment calling for? It can be as simple and full in awareness. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Knowing you're walking towards, when walking towards, walking away, when walking away, knowing reaching, grasping, bending, eating, drinking, defecating, urinating, everything, right? It's just this general sense of, oh, body moving through space, body doing its thing. How many times do I not notice I'm reaching for the refrigerator door before I've opened the refrigerator? Right? Or pick your favorite whatever. Right? That mindless behavior, the noticing it as it happens. This begins to get at the effects of our minds on our bodies and of our bodies on our minds. When is craving present? When is it absent? Noticing our own internal ecosystem. Because noticing is power. Noticing is power. It's when these things, these habituated responses come unconsciously, that's when we're hooked, right? We go on the automatic process and it's all over till afterwards, maybe. Or maybe the wait part of during. So then there's the fruit of the tree, the fruit of the practice. Yoniso manasikara, the Pali, profound attention or wise attention, which includes both discernment and care. It's a kind of emergent attention that wells up from deep within us. And this includes the ability to discern the quality of the heart and mind itself, the atmosphere, the mood, the tone. It can feel a sense of, am I contracted or expansive? Is the mind contractive or expansive? Is it settled or scattered? is it broad and expansive, diffuse? There's no right or wrong answer to any of these. The Buddha's instructions are not to beat ourselves up if we're distracted or remorseful or grumpy or whatever it is. It's simply to notice, because noticing is power. This discernment also includes broader emotions in the mind and noticing, dividing what's occurring in our minds into two categories, helpful and unhelpful, or kusala and akusala, right? That in itself could be a lifelong practice. We just notice, oh, if I buy into this thought, I feel lighter and more whole and more integrated. Oh, if I buy into that thought, grumpy, despairing, whatever it is, right? But just noticing the difference. Dividing the thoughts into two kinds and keeping a closer watch when the unhelpful ones arise is a key practice in the early Buddha's teachings. By noticing stress, anger, resentment, and their ilk, by noticing their effects on the mind and body, eventually our whole system learns, don't go there, right? And it's like a gatekeeper. This is a simile from the suttas, I don't remember which one, but a gatekeeper is, in this simile, is like mindfulness. And he's guarding the one gate in and out of the city. And he knows the way to send messengers to the king quickly if certain arrivals come. Oh, keep an eye out. These bandits are in town, or whatever it is, right? And then there's when the beautiful states of mind arise, balanced by awareness. Then there might be a message to the king, oh, these ambassadors came, or these healers came. Send out a welcome party. Integrate them in more deeply, right? This is a poem based on the Terigata, the songs of the first awakened women. And this book of poetry is done by Maddie Weingast, First Free Women. Some of you probably already know it. I see a couple of nods. This is Jenta. And she says, I was forever getting lost until one day the Buddha told me, to walk this path, you will need seven friends. Mindfulness, interest, courage and energy, joy, calm, settledness, and equanimity. For many years, these friends and I have traveled together, sometimes wandering in circles, sometimes taking the long way round. There were days when I thought I couldn't go on. There were days when I thought I was finally beaten. It's scary to give all of yourself to one thing. What if you don't make it? Oh, my heart, you don't have to go it alone. Train yourself to train just a little more gently. So I took some liberties with his language because he took some liberties with the language. The seven friends are the seven factors of awakening. Some of you recognize them right off, right? But really, like that gatekeeper, to let them in when they're good, to keep them around or encourage them to be around without clinging, right? And friendliness is a really great start. So, another broadening of this awareness, season of awareness, if you will, is to start noticing the forest around the tree, all of the conditions around it, internal and external mindfulness together, and internal and external interwoven in the moment. The Buddha teaches about this importance of scope as the threefold way of practicing mindful awareness: internal, external, and internal and external. And so far, I've mostly been talking about noticing awareness in ourselves, just like the princes noticed the one tree, right? It can be helpful to notice only one tree at a time, in our hearts, in our minds, in ourselves, and to notice our response to it. And other times, it can be more valuable to keep the whole surrounding forest in mind. Aspens and other forests, redwood forests, for example, old growth can function as organisms. Peter Bolobon's work talks about this, the life of trees. How trees communicate, certain species of them, when they're not disrupted, through interlinked root systems, through fungi, even through a kind of, it's not truly a pheromone, but something like that, passed along on the breeze through the leaves. It's a certain kind of collective intelligence, right? I find that beautiful. And we have that kind of collective intelligence, that ability is built into us too. We are somewhat open systems. We're relational creatures, right? So we can pick up on each other's postures, expressions, movements, inferred emotions, messages from their nervous system to our nervous system, if we're open to internal and external mindfulness, without projection. This isn't like mental mind reading, right? It's more checking in. The cashier that looks harried. Maybe just, hey, how's it going? Busy day, huh? Giving other people the opportunity to self-correct or to correct me. But that connection is so powerful. Just like me, everyone experiences stress, sadness, anger, joy, beauty, love, all of it, the whole range. There's a decentering of my experience in a really beautiful way when I let that in. Just like me, we, the larger we. And that shows us impact on each other, the sort of resonance, the strings vibrating. And then there's space also sometimes for something I've talked before about in this group, a non-complementary response. That is, for example, meeting anger with kindness, hostility with non-hostility. There's a couple of anecdotes I have about this. One is, many of you know I've worked as a hospital chaplain for a while. And at one point, I was called down to the waiting room of this local community hospital, and there was this family member. He was PO'd. He was mad. He was loud. And for all I know, he had every right to be. And he was also making a real ruckus for all the other families in the waiting room, none of whom were having a good day. If you're in a hospital waiting room, by definition, you're probably not having a good day. So all I did, there was a security guard kind of in the distance because they were actually kind of concerned about this guy, but I didn't let him come close. And I went up and I just deeply listened to him. I didn't get angry at back. I didn't get defensive back. Just met his eyes and deeply listened. And it was absolutely amazing. It did not take 15 minutes before he completely flipped around. He needed to be heard, felt, met, without defensiveness or anger coming back at him. And the situation hadn't changed, but his attitude about his treatment completely transformed. And so that's, you know, we all have that in us some of the time. Most of us don't have it in us all the time. But to kind of hold it in mind that sometimes the obvious response, the reflexive response, isn't the useful response. Right. Lily Tomlin. People will forget what you said. They will forget what you did, but they will never, ever forget how you made them feel. Right? Others are our mirrors sometimes, and there are times where we can be a mirror that reflects the best back. Not just the difficult stuff. Internal and external mindfulness is also where it's possible to catch bias and views that distort awareness, that distort perception, including actually what we see. So there are many, many examples of this. How many of you have heard of the Project Implicit? Anybody? So if you're interested, you can Google it after this talk, but it's put out by Harvard, and it's this series of tests you can take online. They're all voluntary, it's all anonymous, they aggregate the data, but it's to test your own implicit bias across many, many vectors: race, ability, ethnicity, language, all different kinds. And it tests you by confounding, like what you see and what you hear are not the same thing, and catching the mental processing time. It is absolutely fascinating. So that shows, doing something like that will show you almost in real time, well, sure showed me, where the distortions in my own mind are with regard to other people. Other classes of other people, right? There's also a way that a bias or a view can literally distort what we see. And so I remember this was during sort of the COVID lockdown era, and I was doing a fair amount of retreat because honestly, there just wasn't a whole lot else to do other than Zoom retreat at that particular point in my life. And I remember I was doing walking meditation in my apartment, and there were all these windows out onto the back porch, which was supposedly my back porch, but was kind of shared with the upstairs neighbors. And as I'm walking back and forth, my mindfulness is strong enough that I notice my eyes landing on an object on the porch. I don't even really take in what the object is before the view arises. A, it shouldn't be there, and B, the neighbor put it there. And then there was the annoyance. Boom, 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 just like dominoes, right? The really humbling part about this is the second look revealed it was not a foreign object. My neighbor didn't put it there, and it was just a trick of light. But boy, that view, it just made it this trick of light into a thing. How humbling is that? Another place a lot of people see this is over email. Reading an email and having a certain emotional response based on whatever mood was there, was primed beforehand, or perceptions of the person or the topic. And the blessed moment we don't hit send when there's time to reread the email and realize that actually those words were not in there at all, or they didn't go in the order I thought they did. Right? It's so easy for that distortion to happen. So the mindfulness of sense contact of eye or ear or whatever, and then the review. Oh, as Pema Chodron likes to say, are you sure? Really sure? So then, internal and external becomes where we exercise some of our most important choices. What voices, what sources, what attitudes, information do we amplify in our own hearts and minds? And what do we choose to pass on to others? Because mind states are not ours alone. We are always transmitting and receiving them. And the more mindfulness we have, the more choice we have about what we pick up, what we hold on to, and what we put out. So, the choices we make can equal the difference between cultivating a cultural commons, cultivating relationship, or poisoning the well, right? Big, I'm kind of putting it in slightly dramatic terms, and each of you have seen this in your lives at different points, whether in a one-on-one relationship or collectively. I'm going to close with another gatekeeper story. Now, forgive me, I'm sure I've said this one before in this group. This gatekeeper is in front of one of these city-states back in ancient India, and they are well known to be wise. Word has spread about the wisdom of this person. And so many times when people are moving to the city, they will check in with this gatekeeper before they go into the city. And that particular day, one family comes up. What are the people like here? Tell us. And the gatekeeper rubs their chin and thinks and looks very carefully at the head of the family and says, tell me, what were they like where you used to live? Oh, conniving, mean, backbiting, you couldn't trust them. Awful, rude. The gatekeeper nods sagely and says, I think you'll find people a lot like that here. Then another group comes up a few hours later. Tell me, what are the people like here? Were they like where you were before? Oh, wonderful neighbors, kind, thoughtful, generous. I didn't want to leave, but, you know, my partner got this job and here we are. And so just let us know, what are they like? I think you'll find people a lot like that here. Right? So to recap, the takeaway here is that awareness can take so many forms in breadth, depth, and scope, all of which, any of which can be useful, and any of which can include this internal and external threefold awareness that increases our personal mindfulness, wisdom, and capacity for awakening, and that also increases our capacity to be a source of goodness, connection in the world. Thank you for your kind attention. So we have only one or two moments. I went on long. But if anyone has a question or a comment they'd like to drop in, we do have a moment or two before the closing metta. Yes, Barbara.
I just want to say thank you. I really enjoyed your talk, and I love noticing as noticing is power. I thought that was a wonderful quote, and the way you looked at all kinds of awareness. So thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Appreciate it. Nancy, hi. Oh, you need to unmute yourself.
I don't actually have a question. I just want to say to you that I've been practicing for a long time, and I think the guided meditation is the best one I've ever experienced. It was really great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's quite a compliment. I really appreciate it. I'm glad it was useful for you. Anybody else? Mary Kelly, I should say.
No, I really appreciated it. It's funny because But what I realize when I'm doing my own meditation and I have a regular practice is that there is, just even with awareness, there's levels of, I feel like there's levels of awareness that you have, you know. I mean, just, I mean, and you, where there's, you know, where you, you're noticing things. And I really like the idea of noticing the what's in the inner, what's going on, and then also noticing what's the outer is, and then looking at them both. And if you can hold that, for me, there has to be a certain level of steadiness of mind to get there. And it's, but what really is really nice is really becoming aware of what is my awareness like now. You know, and that's that is so helpful, because then, you know, you can just, I can, you know, if I can drop in and feel my gravity and feel my body, then I could feel more dropped in. And I just remember being on an awareness retreat and thinking, you know, this is like, I've got too much samadhi. There's no way I could drive a car or anything right now, you know, whatever. But then there's other awareness that, you know, I could go do my yogi job and still be okay. And then, that, well, you know, if you could do a yogi job, that means in your household, in your home, you could have that, you know, maybe not that same, that because of the, you know, because of the environment, but it's possible. So, but I think what you pointed today was just what really beautifully clear about how we can be mindful of our mindfulness. So thank you so much for that. Yeah.
You're very welcome. And just to plug that many of you here are very experienced practitioners. This lensing from level to level of mindfulness, it is a skill that can be developed. So that flexibility in of itself, that shifting the seasons of whatever the tree is doing, that's well within your capacity in your practice, as long as you are patient and attend to the conditions. It's not a myth. It's entirely possible. So thank you all very much for your question, all your comments, your kind attention, and most of all, your practice. It's just inspiring to come.